MPA from the JFK School of Government and a BS in Cognitive Science and Artificial Intelligence from Yale, summa cum laude. He's also a 14-year veteran of CISOP of CompuServe's online forums. Give it to you, John.
Thanks, Jeff. Is this up? I guess it is. Well, good morning. I was amazed on the way in as I noticed that at times I was out sort of in the lobby area with the coffee, and there were people absolutely riveted to the television set, sort of just sitting there, slack-jawed, watching TV. And I realized that what they were watching was what was going on in here at exactly the same moment. And sometimes I guess it's just like going to the football game or something. It's better on TV than it is here. So to those of you out in TV land around the corner, hi. We're glad to be here. So our panel has a narrow theme. We call it technology. And in the next 60 minutes, we hope to fully plumb the depths of technology as it relates to e-development. That's somewhat of an ambitious, if narrow, agenda. And we have five panelists who are happy to help us try to accomplish it. So what I was thinking we would do is have each do a self-introduction of a sort, along with just a few minutes, 4 or 5 minutes of why you're on this panel, what you think you're bringing here that may be of interest. And then once that's through, we can talk a little bit among ourselves and then open it up to full participation. So Mr. Akasina, why don't you get us started? Thanks.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. My name is Gabriel Akashin. I work for the United Nations Development Program, and I spent the last 8 years in Asia and the Pacific, basically assisting governments trying to get on the IT and the internet bandwagon, doing a lot of projects of all sorts, and I'm just going to give you a little bit of a rundown of what they were. Technology obviously was a big component of everything we did, but not the only one. Just to give you an idea of the scale of what our program was dealing with, by the way, the program was the Asia-Pacific Development Information Program based in Malaysia. We worked with 42 countries from Iran on one side to Mongolia on the other side and down to the whole Pacific Island countries, and mainly with in three major areas. The first one was capacity building, mainly working with government at expanding their understanding of what the trends and the changes in society were that were due to technology, working with decision makers and getting them a little bit more empowered with understanding what technology could do for the development of their countries. And we did a number of activities in that area, picking up a cross-section of first secretaries type of people at the level just below ministers, and getting them in one room and showing them what technology was doing, with the idea of leading to public policies that were more respectful of these changes. And in a number of countries, we achieved exactly that, which then led to deregulation of certain sectors and an expansion of services and opportunities. The other area which was very important was technical assistance, because a number of countries have, especially developing countries in Asia, which ranges from the Singapore of this world to obviously countries that haven't even started on that path, was to provide some on-the-ground practical assistance in getting anything from connecting countries to the internet. In this February, we connected East Timor, that had absolutely no communication capacity to the internet. Last year, we did Bhutan, which is a small kingdom in the Himalayas and a Pacific Island countries. And I did a few countries before at the beginning of the 90s. To going to a network for farmers, for instance, to provide market prices to people that were dealing with middlemen. So, you know, to kind of assist them in getting the information they needed at the place they needed. Obviously, doing this, there was another component, which was to develop technologies that were appropriate to developing countries. We live under the constraints of technologies that are developed for the north, for countries that have identity, urban population, and so on and so forth. But when you go to countries that have a very dispersed population, those technologies have to be adapted in a way that I don't know how much we want to go in the technology of this, because it gets very complex very quickly. But we had successfully implemented services where you can go we can use, for instance, satellite space very efficiently, beaming down a small amount of bandwidth to one hospital, one school, one community here and there. And I disagree with a number of people that say that connectivity will be fast, to be interesting. Just to give you an example, in 1993, we connected the entire campus of the University of the South Pacific with a 2.4 kilobit per second connection. There were 600 people on it. You would get your email in 2 days later, but you will get your email. And the difference between zero and any amount above that is the difference. Then everything improves in time. And for instance, today in East Timor, we have 256K, and we have a user population of about 1,000 people, including the World Bank, by the way, which was one of our first clients. But it works really well. So the research for this research and development of technology that were appropriate to developing countries, and again, we dealt with countries that were really isolated. I mean, without going through the major countries like China, there are a lot of countries within it, or the states in India, for instance, was one of the third major component of what we did. And I think today we're sitting on packages of technology which are always hybrid and include, obviously, always last mile consideration, which may be a bicycle, really, you know, going from wherever the information lands to the way information has to get to, and include satellite technologies of various kinds, wireless technology wherever is appropriate, some perhaps land-based infrastructure whenever it's possible, et cetera, et cetera. So these are the major area that do it. I want to make two final considerations for just 1 minute. First of all, I'm a practitioner. I'm not a theoretician of information technology, but I have addressed and somehow been forced to deal with the problem of the digital divide. I just want to say that to everybody that I don't agree with that term. I think the divides we have today are social and are economic in nature. The digits we found are the bridges, are the ways to get countries to talk to each other, to really take advantage of what is happening rather than the opposite. We cannot expect any country to be advanced if the social and economic divides are so large like that today. So I think we have now, for the first time, a tool that can assist us in getting things done. And also the probably last consideration is that the sequencing of technology in countries has two components which are very important for us at least. One is that you don't get to the technology until you have crossed the political layer, policies, and the financial layer, which is sometimes very important. We the previous panel threw in a lot of consideration about funding. Well, connecting East Timor costed us $40,000. It's not a real huge amount. Connecting Bhutan to the internet costed us $50,000. It's not a huge amount. Obviously, you're going to have to pay the bill every month, and that is when you need to kind of work in a sustainable mechanism for doing so. And that is usually possible in this area because you're probably getting users that are willing to spend some to have creativity. And the last layer is the technical layer, which you arrive to after you cross the previous two, but not before, because technology is kind of sexy and everybody wants to get to it, but very often a computer doesn't do it, you know, because it's either not used properly or not connected to anything or just doesn't produce much. And so the last consideration I want to do, the sequencing on how technology arrives, especially in rural areas, is changing a lot. Before we used to say that electricity comes first, telephone comes second, and the last thing that arrives is data. Today we're actually reversing that process. I'm pushing one of the concepts that we're working on in developing countries, the one of e-jobs, the fact that we can now use data to move employment to countries. And we've already a fairly good idea on how to do that. So in that case, data would arrive first. Electricity would be a luxury because it would basically lit up your kitchen unless you can do something with it. And when that time comes, you would have electricity, but before it would still be a luxury and a bill you have to pay. So we're looking at now data first and perhaps, which also carry voice, by the way, in a number of contexts, you know, and we do this all the time, basically, and then electricity arriving last. So there are a number of concepts that are changing because of that, and that's, you know, some of the things we're looking at. Thanks.
Gabriel, thank you. I encourage you. He's the regional coordinator of the Asia Pacific Development Information Program, abbreviated to APDIP, I don't know if it's FDIP or APDIP, but I went to the website, however it's pronounced, and it's a fascinating website which includes the timestamp of the very first packet that came from East Timor. Once in February, he helped to hook it up. The first packet, I think, was sort of a ping packet. The second was a Napster request. So they're really getting along just fine. Gabriel, before you move on, let me just ask you quickly. There is a sort of Prometheus-like undercurrent to this, however you phrase it, that you can bring in your wake for free to a given country, you know, the first steps to get it onto the internet. Once you've hooked up a particular hub, wherever you chose in East Timor, do you have a sense or do you try to ask anything of those whom you are hooking up as to what they'll do next vis-a-vis everybody else in the country? Is there some Johnny Appleseed-like quality that you're asking of them to hook the rest of the people into their hub, or is it more, here it is for you, maybe we'll hook up some other people, but we just wanted to get you started?
Well, I think it's a very interesting question. We always work in a way that we try to build into the project a mechanism that would have that component. So far we've been very lucky, but again, this is usually a winning situation because you're going through East Timor is extraordinarily good because obviously you had the bubble of international aid coming into the country and no connectivity. So in the moment that you do the first ping thing, yeah, which is a great moment for anyone if you've ever done it, and then you plug in your Ethernet cable into the system, you see that people's face change because now they are connected. But let me give you another example. For instance, Bhutan, which was, again, a very small country, 700,000 people. I seem to have done a lot of 700,000 people countries in my life, but I don't know why they always turn. But what we did before, and also there was the case of Fiji, was to have the country on an intranet. So they already were exchanging local information through an IT-based system. So it really was a little bit like the picture you imagine is to plug in the entire country to the global network. And then a number of things get enabled because of that, and you would have a number of points that now have already thought about what is that they're going to do with this, so they will proliferate downstream into more connectivity, yeah, and so on and so forth. And that is, in countries where we also seen deregulation, Nepal is probably the best example. You had overnight, when the visa would be regulated, so landing permits were granted, and you had overnight a boom of an industry that wasn't really there the day before.
Yeah.
So
it's an amazing phenomenon. Use the technology to have the ethos of information sharing going at the moment you then hook up the hub, you immediately hook up the spokes.
Exactly.
Very un-Bill Gates-like way of conceiving of it. Michael Best, tell us about yourself.
Thanks very much. My name is Michael Best, and I work here at the Media Laboratory. I lead an effort called eDevelopment, the eDevelopment group here, and I know it might seem completely unlikely, but there is actually, it's mostly coincidence that the name of my group and the name of this symposium are the same, honest. Gabriel talked about the difference between practice and theory. I am a practitioner. I'm a technologist. And yesterday, if you were here, I talked a lot about some of the development e-commerce initiatives that my students in my group and others in the laboratory are working on around agricultural management and agribusiness support environments, telecenter cost estimators, basic voice messaging and communication systems, and spot labor market and day labor support environments are the main projects that we have going right now around development e-commerce environments. Today, I'm going to talk more about my thinking around interface technologies for developing communities. And if I can act now like a theorist rather than a practitioner, I would like to frame it sort of like a philosopher might conceptually divide up the world. So sometimes philosophers like to sort of produce a conceptual problem space that divides questions amongst those that are true, those that are beautiful, and those things that are just or right. In other words, there is an epistemology, an aesthetic, and an ethics. And what I want to think of myself as working on is ethical technology. In other words, I'm trying to consider technologies that are just or right. And in doing so, I've kind of formulated a catchphrase, perhaps clumsily, beyond the desktop. And by beyond the desktop, I mean at least three things in terms of interface and interaction to technologies. I mean beyond the desktop in terms of the actual physical computer. And these are sort of practical, primarily practical considerations around them. Beyond the desktop in terms of the physical computer, meaning some people around the lab, including Mitchell Resnick, like to remind us that the normal desktop computer was designed by a bunch of folks weaned on the television, and so no surprises, it looks like a television. But for 4 billion people outside of North America, Europe, and Japan, who may or may not be weaned on the television, and of course, actually, television penetrations in places like India is actually quite dramatic. And for those of us actually living in North America, that sort of desktop structure, that sort of TV appearance, doesn't to me necessarily make any sense in terms of an ethical technology. And so one of the kind of thrusts that I'm considering is how to break out of the box, as it were, and move beyond the desktop computer into digital appliances and access terminals that aren't so one-size-fits-all and that might go to, apply to different sorts of application areas. Actually, I know from Saul we're going to hear a lot about sort of some different kinds of forms of technologies that in the laboratory anyway, here at the Media Lab, they're building around new access terminals. And some students in some other areas of the lab are working on very elaborate haptic interfaces that kind of have this sort of approach beyond the physical desktop, breaking out of the box ethic to them. The second kind of way that I think about sort of beyond the desktop is also away from sort of where a desktop computer generally sits. Obviously, a desktop computer sits, well, on the top of a desk right now. And when I'm thinking beyond the desktop, I'm also thinking about how one can penetrate physically into, say, a rural developing community through some different, say, radio technologies. Village area networking is kind of an area that we're exploring in the laboratory. I know when we hear from Ashok Jhunjhunwala, we might hear about some village area type networking technology that would allow the information technologies to penetrate off of a desktop and into, in particular, rural areas and into developing communities. And the third area that I kind of like to think about in terms of beyond the desktop, and where certainly I've been putting some effort and many of my students have in the laboratory, is beyond the desktop metaphor of usage that sort of is being radiating out of Redmond, Washington. Now, all of us who know that kind of the name they use for that Windows-based folders and files is, that's your desktop. And that's kind of what the Pacific Northwest has decided that the world wants in terms of a metaphor for usage. It constantly amazes me that people don't even ask the question, why would we want a desktop metaphor of usage or mode of interaction if we don't value desks? If, what would a agriculture-based metaphor of usage look like? What would a family or geography-based mode of interaction kind of mean to different communities? Because I'm not sure that the desktop metaphor makes sense for the heartland of the United States. I'm not sure it makes sense for the Mekong Delta in Vietnam, for rural Ghana, for Hazaribad, Bihar, India. It only makes sense for those of us on this panel because we have 5 years plus probably of absolutely pulling out, gut-wrenching, ulcerating experience with that style of interaction, and we've more or less come to, grin and bear it. But I think that, in general, we should be able to ask the question and actually pursue, and this is certainly a technology ethic that we're pursuing here in my work at the laboratory, a type of beyond-the-desktop metaphor of usage that might be more appropriate, that might be more community-based, that might be more less alienating than kind of what what we're all sort of stuck with from in particular the folks who produce Windows. That has actually then been realized, at least in some research technologies around, say, for instance, agricultural support systems that have more of a geography-based set of interfaces. And we're currently sort of researching a variety of different types of interface construction ideas that would allow communities to actually construct or build their own appropriate sort of ways to think about information technologies that go towards the application areas that actually respond to sort of their legitimate concerns and demands and development goals in a humanistic way. So again, I allowed myself to sort of mostly think about these things not as a practitioner, though in point of fact I am just a technologist practitioner, but more in terms of a theoretical framework, because I think that by doing so it reveals what an ethical technology might actually arrive us or point us to, and both ultimately lead us to a collection of technologies that are very different than what today we describe as desktop technologies.
So, Michael, it's ethical technology is such a wonderfully loaded and provocative pair of words, and it's sort of, I just feel like the fire hydrant of ideas you've treated us to in the past 5 minutes, my head is still spinning in a useful way, of course. This is a good thing. It's not the desktop confusion you were talking about before. I'm just curious then, when you say ethical technology, at first my mind, locked as it is culturally around here, thought of Robert Oppenheimer. And I'm thinking, okay, a bomb is not a very ethical technology wherever you may choose to drop it. But what I hear you saying is not so much we simply look at a given technology and can see the ethics of it, but we have to view it vis-a-vis the people using it. And it's sort of a non-cultural imperialist point that says instead of, you know, a laptop may be a perfectly ethical technology, TV like though it is in this room, but there may be other communities and cultures that are just starting to really embrace technology for which something else may be different. I just want to get a reality check and see, is that what you mean?
Yes, I mean, I think that all of this is totally context-based and it's community-driven. So I can only just underline what you just said. What might be, again, an ethical technology for us in North America or for us in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or for us in the Media Laboratory need not necessarily be one for, again, the Mekong Delta region of Vietnam. But what I think is true is that there are ways in which we can envision collaborative design processes, construction based or toolkits that would allow people within a community to build their own ethical technology such that this is not an intractable problem. In other words, the one thing that I don't want to give the impression is that I think everything is so contextualized such that we can't get traction or make progress on deep new modes of interaction, deep new ethical technologies, say here, coming together from, 38 countries like we do today, in the Media Lab, because in point of fact, I do think that there are principles, design principles that can be sort of formulated that would go towards ethical technology that will still nonetheless look different in sort of their realization within a variety of contexts.
Gotcha. And just for reference, what's a haptic interface?
Touch. Interface.
Gotcha. Good. Thank you. Brian Herlihy.
Hi. I'm representing Africa One, and before I tell you what Africa One is, let me just give you a brief history of my background. I come from an international economics background, and my international economics work was done on Africa in particular. When I was attracted to the Africa One project, I was brought on to the financial side. So I'm trying to marry the two because we're finding out from the financiers' interest that there are some economic worries that a $2 billion network might not be justified in Africa. Having said that, let me tell you a little bit about Africa One and its history, its death, and now its rebirth. Africa One started as part of an AT&T project that was urged by the ITU. It was supposed to be a semi-private, semi-consortium network that would encircle all of Africa. The project floated through AT&T and made progress on market study aspects, but didn't make progress on actually being deployed from 93 to 97, at which point the AT&T submarine cable division that was responsible for the project was sold to Tyco. Tyco then said that they weren't interested in actually building networks, but were interested in designing networks, and hence the project was dropped. At which point, some of the main players of the then AT&T submarine cable, which turned into Tyco, decided that they were interested in building networks and left and started Global Crossing, which has now become the fourth largest carrier and has proven, I think, that it is a successful undertaking. In 1999, Bill Carter, who started the Global Crossing project, was approached by Lucent and several other investors and said, well, we'd like to start the Africa One project again. And since then, we've been going full out on trying to get financing and develop and deploy the project itself. The project, in the most general terms, because it changes daily, is a $2 billion fiber optic network that will encircle the entire continent of Africa and link into Global Crossing's global network. The goal is to create connectivity to every country in Africa that is willing to participate. The way that we've gone about this is we've looked at a market study of the African telecommunications network, and then we've worked directly with the African carriers, in most cases the incumbent carrier, where possible new carriers. What we've found from this market study that's gone into great detail of actually projecting E1s needed through 2014 is that Africa does have a strong need for global connectivity and connectivity between the countries themselves. From the financing aspect, let me just back up and tell you a little bit how we're approaching this. We're approaching it as a self-financed project from three-quarters of the pricing and equity investment for the other quarter. Again, those numbers are rough and change every day we sit down with the vendors. But what we believe is that there is an investment that is worth private equity having a return. And we believe also that this return, although it might not be as large as something from an Atlantic Crossing, pays off fairly soon. Now, when you look at our numbers and you look at our market study, it's dependent obviously on a large number of countries, but it's our belief that you'll sort of have a domino effect, and once connectivity is there, you'll have encouragement of foreign direct investment, et cetera. Now, the other aspect of what I look at personally for Africa One is the economic development within African countries. And where my concern lies is there a market within the country itself to build out the needed national networks that would be required to carry the capacity we believe is there? This becomes a more difficult task because you're really projecting the spending habits of a certain consumer market. Our studies have shown that even with large PC penetration, the numbers are nowhere near they are here in North America or even in South America. The numbers sometimes top 1% of the local market. What this means is we have to look at that 1% as our whole consumer market and see if they'll justify spending the amount of their GDP per capita on telecommunications. And what we're seeing through these studies is quite optimistic. We've sort of benchmarked that someone might spend up to 4% of their total GDP per capita on all their telecommunication needs, so internet, fixed line, wireless. Now, obviously, that sounds like a high number, and it's not even close to what I know I spend on my GDP per capita, but when you look at it, this number is skewed by the fact that there is large companies that might be making personal investments, and that the 1% in many of the countries we're looking at has a much higher GDP per capita than the overall GDP per capita. When I say much higher, I might mean 100-fold or even more. So having said that, we are pushing forward with the project, and we are very happy with the project and how it's progressing. We are in final stages with our suppliers. We are hoping to start our survey on the landing points. We are hoping to have our finances secured by the end of the year, and we're hoping to have commitments from at least 20 to 25 national carriers with additional commitments from U.S. Carriers, European carriers, and when possible second carriers in the given countries. I know the Africa One project has had its highs and lows from 1993 to now, so I always meet people who either have no understanding of it or have understandings of it of different points in its cycle. So people look at me sometimes when I hand them my business card and say, oh, well, you know, they kind of feel sorry for me, thinking I've been fired. So I'd be glad to answer, you know, more specifically where we are and more specifically of how the birth of the new Africa One came out and how it's being accepted by the national carriers. There at first was a very strong feeling like we had abandoned them at first. And now when we've gone back and said, here we are again, there's a skepticism of whether they want to commit the money to make an original capacity purchase.
Ryan, thank you. This is fascinating because in some sense, you and Gabriel are roughly in the same business. And we have the .org/.int over here. Gabriel, who's, you know, he gets the thin satellite link in. He's trying to hook people up. I get this picture of him with a wrench under a desk just sort of tightening that last lug nut somewhere. And then Brian is .com, right? At the end of the day, you've got to build a sustainable model that will give a return on investment. You've got to make good calculations about market power and GDP and everything else. And yet you're both sort of trying to do the same thing. So as you plow billions into fiber optics, it's wiring around Africa as you described, I'm curious, do you have a sense of what possible business models will happen within individual countries as you hook into the local, often monopoly or state-run carriers? I imagine your money comes from them, right? They pay you some fee, and it's up to them to figure out how to, if not outright recoup, actually make a profit by in turn charging those within the country for internet access. Do you have a sense, are they going to do it by the minute? Are they going to do it to some and not to others, differential pricing, et cetera, et cetera? How does it work?
Well, I think there's a number of aspects to it. One, when you look at their business model, you would assume it's the same business model that happens in the States. So you do have pricing per minute, but you also have the ability to lease a line. You also have the ability to buy an IRU on an E1 capacity. Ideally, what you'd like to see and what we're finding out now is there's a lot of privatization and liberalization of the markets in Africa. And I think that's because of the strong work of the World Bank and the IMF. And it's encouraging multiple carriers to enter into the market. What we're seeing when there are multiple carriers entering into the market is that they're pushing from beyond the city and they're pushing out farther and farther to find a larger market base. They're also pushing the price down. Now, we work and we encourage ourselves and others to work with the satellite companies because building terrestrial networks, whether they be fiber or wireless, is expensive and it takes a lot of time. And there's a lot of areas that we can't reach right away, and we think satellite's an ideal solution for that. There's also a lot of aspects of whether or not there's a market for the national carriers. We're finding that many of the national carriers are reactive instead of proactive. So
I'm shocked. Just shocked.
Yeah. So what we are finding is that we're trying to encourage them by doing, we've done business cases for every country for them to show them, look, there is a market. You should be building these networks in anticipation of this market. And you should be finding finance now as opposed to 2002, January 1st, when our cable's done, and you said, oh, but, you know, by the way, we don't have our national network done. So we actually work very strongly with the countries and the carriers to facilitate this.
So I'm sensitive on time passing, but just one more quick question. Is it your sense, as you give these models to the Ministry of Posts and Telecoms or the respective monopolists or fading monopolists in each country, is what's persuasive to them, the idea that the urban, most advanced areas, the office towers that may be in the one capital or something, those are the ones they can wire up first and get a static flow of money from before they start going outward? Are you really thinking consumer demand? These are people that may either be through cyber cafes or dial up or some other wire run to them. That's where the money's going to come from.
Well, I think the natural progression is starting in the population-dense areas, so we are seeing it in the city. But most countries that take Botswana, granted they have an advanced system, but they're building fiber rings that are getting farther and farther out. And if this is by choice of Botswana Telecom or not, they're being forced to do this because the wireless companies are pushing farther and farther out. So most fixed-line companies are finding heavy competition from the wireless companies, and they're looking at the market as more and more the entire country.
Gotcha. Thanks. Saul Griffith.
Hi, I'm Saul Griffith. I'm a PhD candidate here in the Nanomedia Group, Professor Joe Jacobson. I guess I'm very much an on-the-ground technologist, which gives me a license to show lots of pretty pictures. Hopefully they'll come up quickly.
Pump 7, please, unleaded. I can describe what's on his screen, if that would be helpful.
I guess this is where we really get to test those 5 years of experience with interfaces. No, still nothing.
I'm going to say, I'm so glad we're not at Harvard Law School. This isn't my fault.
Luckily, I bought lots of hardware, too.
Ah, there we go. There's
oh, here we are.
Are you Electronic Ink?
That's the one. Okay, so this is, some of you were here yesterday will have been made aware of this already. This is the original product of our group. This is a very low-powered draw, bistable electrostatic display mechanism called the Ink. This is another version of that here, a little piece of hardware. This technology was developed as a very low-cost route for large area display means. If we move to the next slide, unfortunately I can't see it here now, it's only behind me, so I have to imagine what's there. This is the one. So I thought it was very interesting that Mike talked about how your design parameters, or what you were thinking about during developing technology affects the development of the technology. This is very much a slide that motivates most of the students in our group. This is sort of the ultimate tool that we would like to build, which is a very low-cost electronic book with a low-power display that you can, for example, pack with 1,000 textbooks. You could fit an entire school curriculum into one book-size piece of technology. And so we have developed the display technology for that, and we are now working on the printed transistors or printed logic. How do you get away from the very expensive manufacturing techniques of silicon-based technology and go into a paradigm where you can literally print logic and computers onto low costs of plastic and glass substrates? This is a printed memory that we have developed as part of that application, which is literally based on carbon black or crushed and burnt car tires. And this is literally a printable technology, meaning you can use something analogous to your desktop inkjet printer to print a working memory device. In terms of how we're going around the moving away from the silicon paradigm, we're looking at developing inks that can be printed again. This is a cadmium selenide semiconducting ink, and so this is the active device ink that you would print to make computers and logic. This demonstrates, hopefully I can make a little video play here while I talk. This is, again, showing that we're very much concerned in our group about how you can use desktop-type technologies, again, an inkjet printer. And this is an electrostatic drive motor that was printed with an inkjet printer using a silver colloidal material similar to the ink you saw in the previous slide. Hopefully you'll see little glass particles driving from one side to the other of this slide. That means that we have actually printed a working motor onto a plastic substrate using a liquid ink. And so you can start to imagine printing very low-cost medical devices and small micro-machines and sensors for environmental sensing, for example, and for very low-cost use. And so I guess all of these slides sort of indicate And this is another...
This first investor.
Okay, this slide represents sort of the main technique we're now using, which is a printed elastomeric stamp style technique. So we're looking at roll-to-roll printing processes. This is very much a gravure-type printing process, and you can see sub-micron size features. The features in these slides are the same feature sizes as would be on a contemporary silicon chip, as in your Intel processor. However, these have literally been printed with a rubber stamp. And this is sort of where we're working towards, ultimately, is flexible, low-cost printed devices. Now, I'll just briefly introduce something else that is very much in sort of a Victor Papanek design for the real world type of way. There was a class held here last semester called Wind Up Browser, and very much the overarching principle of that class was how do you design for less than $10 the aforementioned book that holds a complete school curriculum for under $10. And the very nice thing about having that, if you had that as the goal from the outcome, goal from the outset, and you put a whole lot of sort of creative MIT type engineers on the problem, you get lots of different solutions. And you'll see in this slide, in the top left-hand corner, that's actually an e-ink based. These are mostly conceptual, except the one in the bottom right was actually built. So in the top left-hand corner, that's actually a VHS tape, which holds 3 gigabytes of data. That's more than enough to hold, I think that was 100,000 books. With an e-ink display on the surface. To the right of that, you see a lenslet array. This is you can cast this in glass, for example, and get 1,000 printed sheets from a single page. So you use those little lenses to amplify some very small printed text. In the lower left corner, you see basically this is a audio cassette tape using microfilm and magnetic media. So this is like a little projector that you could use to hold, in that case, I think it was about 90,000 pages of text. And all of these devices, you know, are conceivably buildable for $5 to $10. And in the bottom right corner, this is actually the 50-cent browser. This is literally a microfilm projector using a white LED. And for 50 cents, you can get about 1,000 pages of text in the size of sort of one sheet of text. Also, sort of developing out of that class are a number of things, because we were really thinking about all of the whole scheme of education and low-cost technologies. And in the top left-hand corner, this is addressing the power issue. This is actually a generic wind-up technology that can produce 6 watts of power to drive all of the sort of devices that have been previously mentioned. This one I actually have here, but rather than knock the heads off my other panel members, this is based on the old slingshot technology. However, it's just showing that, you know, there are many creative solutions from the sublime to the slightly ridiculous that can be used. But also on this slide, you'll see in the top right-hand corner a picture of Project Pengachu. This is the same students who took that original class 1 year later have now developed a $50 Motorola chip, Linux-based browser that is a wireless enabled. So they didn't quite hit the $10 mark, but they now have a two-way communicating computational device that's all based on freeware and shareware and the Linux platform. And you can see that just that original design goal has definitely influenced what the technologists are building. In the bottom left-hand corner there, this is a cardboard structure that was built in collaboration with SCA, a sponsor here. The idea being, can you build a complete building out of cardboard with printed text, for example, you know, a substantial portion of the school curriculum actually on the walls and surfaces of that cardboard. The top right hand corner is actually the guts of the Pengachu. So if I can just show one last thing. This has just to go on a little bit about how really it is your what technology you get out depends upon the sort of design parameters you put in. This is a project called ThinkCycle, myself and a number of other students here, where we are looking to collect sort of design challenges from people in the developing world and say, you know, tell us what technology needs to be developed, and then you use that to run classes. We'll actually be running a class here next semester, taking real-world problems and using those as sort of motivation for dictating the technology that we build, which is very different from taking sort of first-world design programs, in which case you sort of use the Windows metaphor. Hopefully this will allow us to develop technology that's very much aimed at the appropriate audiences.
Basal, short of bringing a petting zoo with you, I'm not sure how you could have more kind of had people drooling with anticipation of some of these things, including an Ethernet-enabled mouse pad with all sorts of, I guess maybe it's not a mouse pad? It's not a mouse pad.
Not quite a mouse pad, but it certainly, has the mouse pad feel.
Yes, it's quite fascinating. It sounds like your group rises to challenges. I'd just love to see if they could build a water purification system out of cigarette butts and you know, candy bar wrappers or something.
Well,
just give them the challenge and let them run with it. So this is incredible. Now, I imagine there are some labs scattered throughout the world. You know, the old Bell Labs, now Lucent Technologies, that sort of thing. 3M, right, the people that gave us the post-it note and we have yet to fully recover. These folks are working day in, day out to build new, interesting, useful technologies, get a patent on them, and then make a mint. Does your model differ from that? You invent one of these things, do you get a patent on it?
Well, in the case of the printed electronics, it would be naive to say that we were wholly developing that for developing world applications. Obviously, there's a great deal of interest from most of the sponsors of this laboratory for that technology for low-cost printed tags, and you know, they would also like to be able to have sort of animated advertising, this type of thing. But I don't, in that case, that's certainly, that is financing it, but that is not providing the motivation for a lot of the people working on it. There still are altruists working in technology, I think.
Fascinating. Dr. Jujanwala.
Thank you. I'm going to talk about, very briefly, technology for developed nations. Developing countries like India have a very large untapped market. For example, my own country, India, has a 1 billion people, 180 million households. So it is a very large market. But what does that market can absorb? What does it really mean? I'll take one or two examples. One example is telecom and internet, where I'm a little more familiar with. For example, at the telecom and internet today, to install a telecom and telephone and internet line, today it costs pretty much anywhere in the world around $900 to $1,000. Some other countries, it may be even more. The interesting thing is, at $900 to $1,000, the affordability in the country is about 1.5% to 2%. And even if you make it 850, 800, you find the affordability goes up maybe 2, 2.5%. But one other interesting thing that you find, that if you can reduce the cost to close to $250 per line, as the total cost of putting the infrastructure, everything inclusive, the affordability becomes 50% of the households. So suddenly you find that from 5-10 million market, you are suddenly looking, at 130, 140 million market. I think this is a characteristic of many, many developing nations. I am more familiar with India, that you actually, a technology which is developed in the Western market, it is mature in the Western market, doing extremely well. If you take that technology and bring them to a country like India, it is affordable at times to 1%, sometimes maybe 2, 3, 5%, but not more than that. But if, and at this particular point, you find that the cost, since it is affordable at large in the West, there is really no focus anymore on cost reduction. The focus becomes trying to give more features and services, keeping the cost constant. I think what Simo Papert mentioned in the morning, that we used to have a $1,000 PC in 1983 and a $1,000 PC today. We don't have a $100 lower cost, maybe a little lower function PC, basically because maybe $1,000 is affordable out here. But when you take it to a country like India, it is affordable to about 1% to 2%. On the other hand, if you can reduce the cost, at that, from starting from the point of the point where it is already mature and affordable in the West, if you can reduce the cost by a factor of 3 to 5, I believe that there is a market size of about 500 million that none of these technologies reaches in the world. And this is, to some extent, the e-development, and to some extent, the Digital Nation Seminar, as far as I'm concerned, is to try to reach this 500 million market, which we are, by and large, on not touching. The question has been sometimes asked to me, and probably in MIT Media Lab, this question would not be asked, but many people have asked that, is the cost reduction by a factor of 3 to 5 possible? Is, for example, telecom and internet, can you really look at a $250 per line solution, total per line solution? Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's a challenge to R&D. I think we have not really focused on that. We stopped focusing. Once the cost becomes affordable in the West, we stop focusing on it. If we really focus on it, then in many, many areas, I won't say necessarily in all areas, many, many areas, cost reduction by a factor of 3 to 5 is possible. It has a large reward in terms of large market size, so I'm not talking about charity, I'm talking about economic model. And in the process of reducing the cost factor by 3 to 5, we also become the technology leader. So we are really not talking about low-end technology, we are talking about high-end technology. For example, our own group about 4 to 5 years back started this whole exercise. The cost of per telephone line in India was $800. And internet, if you add, it will be even more. And we focused, we said we want to reduce the cost to $250 per line and provide telecom and internet to very large number of people in telephone, in urban areas, in small towns, and in rural areas. And at the institute, we incubated 5 companies focused in this particular direction. We have developed a range of access products. I'm not going to go into detail of those. And today, we're proud to say that we have really reduced the cost of providing simultaneous telephone and internet from around $800 to $900, which is prevalent to something close to $400. We are not yet at $250. We are not happy at $400, but I feel that $200 is reachable. For example, this wireless local loop system that we have developed provides simultaneous telephone and either 35 or 70 kilobit per second internet. And we have developed every piece of this, every piece of hardware, every piece of software, the power supplies, the power backup, everything. The only thing that we have used here is the Linux open source. That's the only thing that we've used. Every piece is owned by us because that was essential. Because the whole thing, technology had to be turned upside down to really develop this. And today we are deploying this. For example, in India, in Andhra Pradesh, in Chittoor district, in Kuppam district, we have provided internet connection at 35 and 70 kilobit per second in every village. Probably the largest number of villages in a particular area where internet connection is provided. And I'm talking about providing in every village. I'm not talking about providing here and there. I'm talking about in India, particularly, there is a fairly large population density, and we are talking about fairly good amount of usage. We have also deployed our system, though we did not focus on other developing countries, but we found that our technology can be useful. And we have today deployed solution in Argentina, Brazil, Madagascar, and a number of other countries. In fact, the key problem that we are finding today is the problem that was mentioned by several speakers yesterday, is a low-cost access terminal. A PC cost is just too high. And number two, most of our places do not have, villages do not have power for about 10 hours, 12 hours a day, so we need power backup. And if we start putting 150 watts that a normal PC consumes, if we try to put power backup for 10 to 15 hours, it just becomes too costly. So on the other hand, I'm very, very clear that it is a solvable problem. It is not a problem, it is not a magic. I think today we all know processors, and much of the work that I'm seeing in MIT Media Lab, that there are elements of what can become a very low cost terminal and can become ethical terminal and can become a terminal which pervades in all kinds of situations, and we can provide the connectivity. I feel connectivity is very important. Without connectivity is power. In fact, I disagree with Seymour Papert that it is enough to begin with to put PC. I feel that connectivity is very, very important today. Connectivity really empowers people. If India today has done well in terms of today, it has made a mark in this country. Today, it is doing a large amount of technology that is required in this country is being developed in India. It is because internet connections was possible in urban areas. But that has enabled India to become, in last 5 years, suddenly become very powerful in some sense. We still, only 2% of our population have telephone, and maybe less than 0.1% have internet. So we are nowhere where we want to be. But we feel that technologies like this is required to some of them will basically say that I read a book sometime back. Somebody gave me a book. The book is called Innovator's Dilemma. It came out from Clayton and Christian here in from Harvard. And the book was disruptive technological innovation. Basically, the book argued that at some particular point of time, when a technology is very mature, a new technology come up which is inferior in quality, but a much lower cost and expands the market very significantly. That goes and destroys the established technology. And within a few years, in fact, passes even quality in quality that technology. I feel that developing countries like India require a lot of disruptive technologies. Thank you.
Thank you. So the question you ask seems quite a reasonable one. Why is this stuff so expensive, particularly when there were eras when it wasn't so expensive? I remember in 1982 getting a $99 TI-99 4A at JCPenney, hook it up to my television set, my data storage is a cassette recorder, and off I go. And it's gotten a lot better since then, but it certainly hasn't gotten cheaper. In fact, by an order of magnitude or two, it's more expensive. It's a very, very good question. By way of just quickly opening it up a little bit, I'm curious, thinking about what Michael said about ethical technologies and differential uses and needs to relate to technology in different countries, in the 11 or 12 developing nations with which you've had experience, do you have a sense of whether through less expensive or more expensive conduits onto the net, people are wanting to use it for essentially the applications with which the West has become familiar, or will we see a whole blossoming of local uses that may bear no relationship to the uses to which the internet has been put so far?
I think to begin with, it is that the applications are pretty much the rest is similar. But that changes very quickly. For example, in a country like India, education is a key focus. People spend a huge amount of money. In my own state, there are 165 engineering colleges. 65,000 students graduate. This is engineering colleges, not even talking about in that one state in the country. Education, for example, people are willing to pay money, people are willing to work hard, and for example, internet is looked at as a very important source of bringing education, quality education. So I think within very short time, it changes. To begin with, we start with what is the applications useful here.
Is that a not so subtle message to us that we only have 8 minutes left in our panel? That's a no, I guess. Okay. Jumping then back to perhaps Michael or Gabriel and your experiences as we think about ethical technology and the points of deployment as it's starting to go into countries and cultures for which it may well, a la the innovator's dilemma, be quite disruptive in all sorts of ways, not just disruptive of the markets, but disruptive of the culture. Is there a sense if a particular country is saying, we want it in, but we don't want the whole thing? We want a system that's respectful of our particular norms. We want to have, whether it's content filtering or a chance of vetting particular applications or surveillance of its use. Michael, does that strike you as a perfectly reasonable local concern for which the technology is then bent to an ethical purpose, or is it just the opposite?
Well, in the particular case for me of net nannies that come and block content that seems inappropriate, I think I would never go for a solution of that sort. So on that particular concern, I think that the technologies that sort of at least are currently available, that does not, to me, describe what I would think of as an ethical technology, for instance. However, what does seem to me like an appropriate and contextualized sort of approach to, for instance, the content issue on the net would center around dialogues between families and kids and whatever and their usage of, say, the web in that case. So I think that might be even thought of as part of this ethical context under which sort of, in this case, access and content are sort of brought together.
Gotcha. And would it actually seem then affirmatively wrong as one is introducing the technology to see to it that one of the potential bottlenecks, whether governmental or economic, kind of a state actor, that they shouldn't be allowed to impose certain restrictions that, it's like, look, if you want me wiring your computers, this is the deal. This is the way it's going to work. I don't know, Gabriel, maybe that's
just thinking about one very specific example. When we wire Bhutan to the internet, this is a country that allows 3,000 tourists a year because they're too concerned about their environment. And, you know, I totally feel for that. And it took us 1.5 years of work with the government in order to get a piece of paper that allowed us in 1.5 months to do the ISP. And we also provided them with all the information that was to back up control versus non-control issue. We brought people from Singapore, for instance, that spends a lot of money into kind of proxying everything. And then actually after consideration, they decided that they didn't really want to go heavy into the control side. This is also a country that doesn't have a university. This is a country that doesn't really have a lot of specialized expertise in health care. So they really wanted the pipe to go out there, and you need to put order of magnitude there to see what is the pros and what are the cons in terms of the ethics of using technology. But eventually they decided to have basically an open type of system without much control.
Gotcha. So it wasn't totally put to the test as to when they say this is the way we want
but
it.
But this is, we feel, is the trend of most countries, you know.
Gotcha.
In the 4 minutes we have left, we might as well get some questions in. And of course, since the question and the answer can take so long, let's just take these three questions in sequence and then let the panel figure out how they want to answer it. Is there a way of getting a microphone over to people? Yes, sir.
Professor,
is it working? Yeah, I can lend you mine. Let's just see it. Yeah, it's on.
Hello. Hello. Can you hear me? In the back. My name is Professor Rashmi Mayur from Bombay, India. I came to this meeting because my main concern has been bringing the technology for development in the developing world where I've been working with the United Nations for the last 10 years. What is not clear to me is a development enabling community to shape their future. I have a few questions which I want to raise to them. Now, the question is, which communities are we talking about? I think that's my concern. Have we decided these communities, who they are, when in the world? World Bank defines 1.3 billion people who are living on $1 a day. And if you're talking about IT, $1 a day who are earning, what is the benefit of this technology? The second thing is, we are 1 out of 6 people on the planet who are illiterate, just cannot read and write even. What these technologies are going to do for them, or are there other ways to do things? Number three, I think I would like to go to Mark when he raised the question about ethics. I think we are talking about the ethics, which I raised a question about a year ago with Negroponte, is what these technologies are going to do to their real development and to their cultures and to their future. Have we asked these fundamental questions? And I think finally our main question should be whether all these technologies are necessary ways to bring the development of the people with whom we are working. I'm working in close to 82 countries I worked in 10 years. Are these technologies the way to deal with their development, or this big divide which the United Nations Secretary General pointed out on 8th of September, they're bridging the divide between those who have everything and those who don't have. We are all from those who have, and we are talking about the people who do not have. Who are we to talk, and if we are the one to talk, do we really understand their plight, and why after 50 years of all the work of development, we are worse today than we were 50 years ago? I think if we don't answer these questions, all these discussions would be only for the intellectuals and not for the real people of the world. And I think concern of the Secretary General is, can we really bridge the gap? Is this the technology we need, or do we need a different type of global ethics?
Gotcha. Hope you guys are taking good notes. Let's get the second question that was up here. So a question about not just digital divide, but all sorts of other divides and how they relate. Yes.
I have a much simpler question. My name is Al Arisman from Boeing. You were looking for the low-cost PC. We are filling landfills with 486s and low-cost Pentiums that have all the capabilities you described, and they would basically be free, I would think. Has anyone thought about making use of that technology?
Gotcha. Should we get the third question in, and we'll just collectively agree we will go till 11:05 on that clock.
Hi, my name is Owen Johnson. I work for a company called Interdimensions. We develop web systems and have been doing it for about 5 years. That includes everything from user experience to technology. And I have a specific question for Michael about, you know, developing these localized interfaces for, I completely agree with you that that is very much needed. And One locale that I wonder if you consider is that of the extremely experienced user, one which is really just interested in interacting with the computer in the most efficient way possible, one that's been fully educated. It's a challenge we run up against all the time. There's basic users who have no idea what the web is like, even if they know how to use their box, which they usually don't. They still need to use the browser. How do you design a web system that works for them and for the experts who want to get their information quickly? And even more than that, I'll keep it brief, is once you consider this expert system and what that ultimate expert system is, deriving perhaps from like our basic instincts of communication as humans, how do you transition from the localized system that is essentially basic and necessary for people that are not used to interacting with machines in specific ways to this expert system that might be ideal for humans in general?
Gotcha. So 5 minutes left, five people, very provocative and deep questions. Be the best you can do with them going down.
I will, I think what Dr. Rashmi Mayur raised is a difficult question, and I'm not trying to answer the question. But I will put forward my view of why I consider something like this is very important. I'll look at, again, India, because India is something that I understand more. There is supposed to be in the last 10 to 12 years some kind of IT revolution in the metros and large urban areas in India. It has not really gone to anywhere beyond. Most important thing, as far as I am concerned, is not the amount of money that we earn or anything like that, but most important thing that there is a tremendous amount of confidence in the urban areas today, amongst young people, that we are not inferior to anyone else in the world. This was not so even 5 years back. In fact, it was not even as much 3 years back. But the success of even, I will say, small in numbers has resulted into a very widespread confidence. I can go on talking about it, what all things are happening. For example, this year, in my state, in Tamil Nadu, the amount of money that a family is willing to spend on children's education exceeded, for the first time, exceeded the amount that they are willing to spend on their children's marriage. Now, this is a very important thing as far as I'm concerned, something to celebrate. It has not happened for 100 years. And I think, therefore, success makes a huge difference. Whatever little bit work that we have done in rural areas, when we go and put a internet connection in a small in a rural area in a school, the first thing that we hear from a child saying that now I'm not going to be inferior to somebody in Bangalore. And I think this is important. And I think this is what empowering and building confidence is what we are talking about.
Thank you.
And just give you very quickly the first two questions. I work for the United Nations and I've been doing, the bulk of my work is information technology applied to poverty reduction. So I feel for real people with real problems. I understand that. Two very quick answers. Direct interventions are those that the poor people benefit directly by acquiring information that would, for instance, entitle them to sell their agricultural product at a higher price and buy them their supplies at a lower price, making them really wealthier than what they were. We see this pretty much all the time, and the systems work. This is food security type of intervention. Indirect systems are those that will benefit, and India, for instance, is a country that is seeing this every day, that see the benefit coming to middle classes and trickling down through the social texture to people in villages, and we see this again in a number of different areas. Now we are introducing another component, which is providing employment directly to people by, for instance, processing data coming from a number of different sources. And this is something that we start doing and it works quite well, because it's not money going from one country to the other, but it's actually jobs. The second question to General Boeing, we have done this movement of 486 square bit. There are costs involved, very high costs involved. At the end of the day, I'm not sure that unless there is a very specific situation, that is, we try with this team or we try with a number of other countries, unless there is very specific situations, not always is a cost-effective solution. Thanks.
Thank you. Michael?
Yeah, just very, keeping it very briefly, maybe touching on the first and third question. and speaking to the 1.2 or 2 billion people really that live in rural abject poverty generally and are mostly illiterate, one of the areas that we are looking for in sort of the non-expert interface area, I suppose, though I'm not sure I quite resonate with that description. Yeah. Is a multi-literate interface or multi-literate set of interfaces that respect a range of literacy, kind of like there's a knob that you can almost turn and move from a totally voice-based system to a text-based system. So we are looking at multi-literate interfaces that would sort of be respectful for those written literacy skills.
Gotcha. Saul, anything you want to quickly add? Or
I'd like to, just on the first and second questions quickly. One issue I actually worked closely in Sydney on a recycling computer program, and one of the big issues there was actually corporations wanting to destroy completely the hard drives on those computers so there was no trace of their information on it, and that was actually a barrier to using them, unfortunately. I think very important here, and the point I'd like to stress in this discussion, is the initial design constraints you put on developing technology. And I think this addresses the first question. To date, we have sort of continued to develop technology for the sort of top 1% of the top 1% of the people in the world. And I think the very healthy thing about having forums like this is we are finally getting the development community to engage directly with the technologists who will be developing sort of next generation technologies. And I think that's very healthy because then we can really consider from the outset, we can set the right parameters and the right initial constraints for doing that technology. Just one quick example on that. If we look at the internet today, there are roughly 300 to 600 million computers on the internet. Each one of those is burning 100 watts. So in 1 hour of running the internet, you're actually generating about 3 million tons of carbon dioxide if that's coal-fired. Now, that was because we didn't really think when we started building this that the internet would grow the way it did, and we didn't really consider the nature of the technology. So there's a very tangible example of how just not thinking about the initial design constraints has really sort of had roll-on effects.
Gotcha. Negative 2 minutes left. Go for your 20 seconds.
Sure. I think first with the 486 question, I think it is, you know, it's an interesting aspect. But again, you go back to what Ashok was saying about the connectivity. If you look in certain African countries and you look at the actual access charge to get onto the internet and the dial-up cost plus the subscription fee that they're paying to an African online or a different ISP, even right there with those two costs, you're already exceeding what someone's capabilities are. I think to go back to the first question, one of the interesting questions for us as a private company is how do you take a capitalistic venture and bring social responsibility to it? And the biggest problem is creating or decreasing the risk of the investment. And again, that goes back to working with the governments and working with opening up markets and creating transparency to see if what we're actually investing in is something that we can take that risk on and that it's a legitimate risk instead of just a ideal risk. So I think...
Gotcha. Doing good by doing well. Mm-hmm. So I wish we had more time. I'm sorry we don't. I also wish that in, say, 3-4 years, of course, eons in internet time, we could pull exactly these people into the room and see how much what we wanted to have happen did and how much did not. So please join me in thanking our panelists for a very illuminating discussion. And I'd say our agenda is set for the rest of the conference.
Just one quick announcement. And what may be a fitting reminder of some of the challenges of implementing technology in the real world. We've had a glitch in our registration program for the breakout sessions, and basically you're going to have to be self-assigning in these breakout sessions. That means you're going to have to grab the bios of the breakout session leaders, and which are on the table just outside the theater, and possibly...